Today on the show, I'm joined by strategic communications expert and CEO and founder of EO Ipso Communications Consultancy, Oliver Aust. We'll be chatting about the importance of social media for business and CEO communications, crisis communications in light of coronavirus, and how students looking to pursue a career in the field can stand out from the crowd. I'm your host, George Phillips, and you're listening to Insiders, the Oxford University Media Society podcast. So Oliver, it's great to have you here today. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you, George. Thanks for having me.
No, it's really good to have you on the show. And today we're going to be discussing everything communications related. And I know that you have some really great insights, which I think will be really valuable for our listeners. And first of all, you're the CEO of a communications consultancy. And I know that you work a lot in kind of different areas. But could you perhaps give me an overview of the variety of work which falls under the umbrella of communications and perhaps how, I guess, how the industry is different from fields like media consultancy or perhaps even journalism?
Yeah, of course, happy to. So I've been working in communications for the last 20 years and I've been fortunate enough to work both in-house about 10 years for quite well-known companies, as well as a consultant and running my own business. So I know it from all angles, really. And I started off in political communications in Brussels, i.e. lobbying or advocacy, whatever you want to call it, and then moved more into sort of media relations, PR. And today, as sort of CEO and founder of EO Ipso Communications, we are a communications consultancy based in Berlin, and we also work in Brussels and some other places internationally. We focus on three areas of communications: CEO communications, we work with leadership of companies, crisis communications, which is what we spend our days currently working on, and thirdly, strategic communications or strategy. And those obviously go hand in hand, but there are many more areas of communications. As you said, sort of media buying, media agencies, where it's more about sort of pay to play, sort of where should you play advertising, to journalism, which is obviously on the other end of the spectrum, to marketing communications and product communications. And like many fields, it looks sort of samey from the outside, but really is a, you know, it's a specialized word like everywhere else. And as I said, it makes sense to focus on a few areas, which is what we are doing.
That's brilliant. What does your day-to-day look like? I suppose at the moment it must be, you know, it's obviously going to be all up in the air. But generally, does a client approach you with an aim and then you kind of set about working to achieve that aim? How does it work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we've seen a shift over the last few years that leadership teams across the board now realize that communication is a hard skill. Hard skill for them personally, which they have to learn and acquire, because often they're not a CEO and executive because they were great communicators, but because they had great business sense or other skills. And also for organizations, that organizations take communication way more seriously now as they did in the past. And I think this has to do with a number of things like you know, the move to digital communication. So communication is just more present. There are more channels. It gets more complex. And also that a lot of industries have been commoditized. So sort of brand and your personal brand and how you present yourself and what your reputation is has become quite a differentiator. So that's the sort of the background in front of which we are operating. And we're really working at the strategic level. So often, you know, we enter into discussions with leadership teams or chief communicators, and we talk about their biggest challenges. And we always try to help them overcoming those challenges and emerging stronger at the other end. So a big part of what I do, my colleagues do, is spending time with clients, talking about their challenges and finding creative solutions to those challenges, and then helping them implementing it. So, and then it gets sort of more tactical, the channels, the writing, the digital, the digital implementation of the strategies you have developed. But it starts often with sort of, okay, what's the big objective? What is the strategy we can apply here? And what are the tactics that seem to be promising in your situation?
And you've spoken just then about working with leadership, especially in the context of kind of personal brand. And this is something which you address in your podcast, right?
Yes.
Where you kind of look at how CEOs are presenting themselves in the digital landscape more broadly.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. It's a big area. I mean, 20 years ago, it was really the performance of a CEO or leader that determined their success. Today, it's probably perception is more important. So perception today beats performance, which is paradox and not necessarily a good thing, but it's the reality. And there are countless studies that show that if a CEO has a good image and if a CEO is present on various social media channels, that they are more successful, but that the company is more successful. Which is sort of, you wonder how that could be, because social media is not necessarily associated with trust. But I think it's simply because we see people and then we can develop trust. If we don't find people or we don't know about them, it's very hard to develop trust. So social media is actually built for people and not organizations, really. And if you're really good at using these tools, you can use social media and other forms of communication to build trust with your audiences. And that is extremely beneficial for any organization, whether it's in terms of sales or in terms of employer branding, hiring the best talent, which is a huge factor in being successful these days, or, you know, communicating with regulators, politicians, or the wider public.
And you also look at internal communications as well. So not just the relationship between the CEO and customers, but also between the CEO and the people working below them.
Yeah, exactly. So we're looking at all the relationships with the stakeholders, and that's important, in particular at the leadership level, where a CEO may communicate with an internal audience at 9 o'clock, gives a media interview at 10 o'clock, and speaks to investors in the afternoon. So when you think about it, a day of a CEO is intersected by communicating at a very high level with high stakes with different audiences who have different expectations and levels of knowledge about the subject they're talking about. So this is really, really important now for CEOs, and it's only going to become more important. And intersected probably by that is, you know, communicating via social media or going on a podcast. And a lot of these tools are now used internally because big organizations always struggle to reach out to all their employees. And you've probably heard about all these studies that show that actually the majority of employees don't know what the company strategy is, or is pretty disengaged. And this is quite disheartening for a lot of communicators, but it just shows the need to always communicate also with your internal audiences. And it's quite exciting at the moment because there are a lot of new opportunities, in particular podcasts and app-based solutions. And we didn't have these things 10 or 20 years ago, where you had to rely on intranets, for instance, which no one would ever look at. But there's still challenges. For instance, if you have thousands of blue collar workers in different sites, how do you actually reach them in a meaningful way? Town halls, one-to-one conversation, personal conversations, email maybe. So it's quite interesting to see how technology can help to reach in a meaningful way a disparate workforce.
And I suppose that also really humanizes the business as well. You've got a business with, 5,000 employees, and you're seeing the CEO mm-hmm. on Instagram, and you're kind of getting this window into their life, it must help with that kind of connection, even if there's not a kind of physical connection. You feel like you know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the sort of smart young leaders use Instagram and other tools to primarily communicate with their own staff, their own employees. I think this is fantastic because often people wonder sort of, where is she? Where is he? Where's our CEO? Not in the office, but you check on Instagram and they're actually doing something very important for the company right now, and they're transparent about it. And people feel more engaged, they feel more in the know, and good internal communication means you know what's going on, but great internal communications means that you know exactly what's going on, where you want to go as an organization, and also what role you play in that overall strategy. And this is so much more engaging.
Just looking at your client list on your website, I can see that you've worked with a range of people, and that goes right up from kind of international, household name brands down to startups. Do you think that there's almost a divide, I suppose, in terms of how willing CEOs and senior management are to engage with employees on kind of digital platforms, if you compare, a company with an older leadership versus kind of a startup where it's quite agile, dynamic, young employees?
Actually, it's not. And that's sort of surprising, was surprising to me as well. And the fact that we work with sort of huge world market leaders on the one hand and trade associations and traditional industries, and on the other hand, with sort of accelerators in the Berlin startup ecosystem, is because we learn on both sides and we can teach on both sides. So we see what's going on at the edges of knowledge on sort of the leading corporates and the leading startups. And that's really exciting. And Berlin is a good place for that at the moment. To answer your question, it's really about the personality more of the CEO, the leadership team, and the company culture. You know, you can speak to startup CEO and says, no, I don't care about comms. I'm building a scalable business here. You know, this will come later. Maybe I will be hiring a marketing manager at some point. Often they have to learn the lesson first that they never build a successful business without taking communication really seriously, because no one will know about you and it's just not going to work. But they often go through these cycles. Corporates often already know that they are reliant on good communication to attract talent and customers and so on. So they are usually a step ahead in that respect, but they are slowed down often by company culture. So it takes way longer to do the right thing, even if they already know what the right thing is, than in a startup. So the startup can move faster, but they're often not as far ahead on the sort of communications learning curve as the big corporates are. So what I always tell startup leaders is, you know, don't wait. You never communicate too early. Start building relationships with media and, you know, important stakeholders now. And you know, you will reap the benefits later. And it's a slow learning process. But again, I think from what we see now in the startup ecosystem, that people are more looking as well to America, for instance, but also to London, and they see, right, okay, it is actually really important from day one to communicate well.
That's really interesting, actually. And I suppose just building off that, you know, you've spoken about startups looking perhaps to other countries to kind of pick apart the models that they're using. Do you see a difference looking at geographical regions then in terms of how companies are approaching communication strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think America is takes it very seriously, but sometimes it can be a bit, you know, maybe a bit vacuous. And I don't mean to stereotype here, but, you know, it's just a different culture, different style to be a bit more over the top, especially sort of, you know, Germany, France. It's more reserved. Usually it's more sort of, you know, you lead by example, you lead with, you know, your knowledge of the field, and it gets quite technical and quite detailed, which is makes it harder to communicate. But they don't often see communication as sort of the number one priority, whereas an American leader would always see it as one of the top priorities for building a business and making a business future-proof. And I'd say the UK is somewhere in the middle. So it's usually, as in many cases, a sort of mid-Atlantic, if you like.
I just want to backtrack ever so slightly. If we go back to when you were breaking down the areas in which you guys focus at your firm, you touched on crisis communications, which I think is a really important thing that we have a brief discussion about if we look at the current climate, obviously. What's that been like? Because I imagine, you know, in a year's time or whatever, we'll kind of look back and it might rewrite some of the rules in terms of crisis communication, right?
I'm not sure it will. I think the fundamental principles of crisis communications apply in this crisis, and I think they will apply to future crises. But, you know, it depends on what you mean, I guess. This crisis is relatively easy to communicate about, funnily enough, because everyone is in the same boat. It's way harder to communicate if your aircraft crashed or you are, you know, have a case in the High Court or your stock price dropped by 50% yesterday. Those things are way harder to explain. Or why did you suffer that cyber attack that brought your IT to its knees and nothing is working anymore and you can't provide your service? So those are harder challenges from a communications perspective. But obviously this crisis is harder from an operational perspective because it just takes a long time and affects, you know, the whole supply chain and your customers and everyone. And the fundamental, you know, in a nutshell, and I could talk about this for ages because I love this subject. It's really when the stakes are high and it gets really, really challenging for a communicator. In a nutshell, I've developed this like, 3 A's and the 3 D's. And three A's are acknowledge, apologize, act. And if you follow these rules, then you're normally okay in a crisis. It means that you have to acknowledge that the problem exists and you have to do so publicly. You can't wait for others to point it out. You have to apologize, genuinely apologize, like a human being, not pretend to. So you have to apologize, which often doesn't happen because in a lot of companies, people confuse, and especially lawyers confuse apology with acknowledging guilt in the legal sense, which it is not. And as communicators, we know how to strike the balance. And the third one is act, because you can feel sorry for what happened, but people also want to know that you are taking all steps that are in your power to prevent this from happening again, and obviously for mitigating the consequences of the crisis. So if you follow that, you're usually in a good position to maybe even emerge stronger from a crisis, and there are good examples for that as well. Now, the three Ds are deny, diminish, deflect, and I think it's self-explanatory. If you sort of try to blame others, if you diminish the impact of the crisis, if you deny you had anything to do with it, those sorts of things backfire always. It just doesn't work as a crisis communication strategy. But many try, you would be surprised, especially because people get scared internally of legal consequences, or they listen to the wrong people. And then they don't apologize and act. They sort of retreat into their own shell, and often then internal debates start and nothing is being communicated. And those vacuums obviously hurt a company in a crisis.
Mm. So I suppose perhaps what this has shown then is the importance of having that kind of very solid framework in place, which can then be mobilized easily should a crisis arise.
Yeah, you're spot on, because in a crisis, you have to act fast. We talk of the golden hour. So something happens, a big accident, or your IT's down or whatever. You have about 1 hour to get things right in terms of communications, to put out a statement and signal that we know there is an issue, we're working on it, we're really sorry. 1 hour. And that can be Sunday night, right? It doesn't have to be Tuesday, 10 a.m. So you have to be in a position to communicate as a team, within minutes almost. And you have to do it any time, any weekday. And that requires a lot of preparation, a lot of trust among the leadership team and the people who are trusted with communications. And what often happens then is that either it is being questioned what was discussed and agreed before, or people have never really taken the subject of crisis communication seriously, and in a crisis all of a sudden become these roadblocks and say, no, we can't put this out, or we should just discuss this, or we should wait for more information, or whatever the excuses are. So when we help companies prepare, there are usually three things we do. One is a crisis communications menu, where all the draft statements and the chains of command and the contact details of journalists and everything is in there. So you know what to do. That's your master plan for a crisis. Secondly, we basically train the executives, do media training. Even if you have done a lot of media training, crisis communications is different. There's just more at stake, and the dynamics change in media interviews and media engagements. And thirdly, we do simulations ideally with all the people who would work on crisis communications in big companies. So that is across cross teams, from marketing, internal comms, social media, external comms, leadership, operations, legal, etc. And only then you can really see how processes are holding up, how good people are. And there's so many learnings coming out of these. So if you do one or two of these per year, you're already much better prepared as an organization.
I found it really interesting what you said just then as well. You were talking about when you're actually, kind of delivering your statements should a crisis arise. And you were talking about having to deliver it, in a human sense. You've got to be empathetic, and you've really got to understand. You can't just acknowledge, but you have to do it as a human. Do you ever find it difficult to kind of construe that to CEOs or, people who
yes.
are... yes, okay.
Totally, because... I think the reason is that often a CEO is maybe 45, 55, and maybe they've been trained and brought up for decades in a system that has never really valued human communication. And then they're all of a sudden at a level where that's required. And that changes unlearning a lot of the thinking and a lot of the sort of communication skills they may have acquired. And obviously this is not true for everyone, but you see this quite a lot, that the way you communicated within your engineering community or your finance team, maybe the CFO just got promoted or the CTO got promoted to CEO, was completely different to communicating with every employee in the company or the media or investors or a regulator or minister. So this requires a lot of situational awareness, a lot of sort of communicating, sort of audience-specific communication skills. And this is often not what they've practiced over the last 10, 20, 25 years. So it requires a lot of unlearning.
And I suppose it's a lot easier to teach someone to think strategically. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to teach them to be kind of emotionally intelligent if they're not necessarily there already.
Yeah. Yes, that is true. However, people in those situations are usually quite emotionally intelligent and also very intelligent and very quick learners. So it's not an uphill battle, I would say. It just requires a change in mindset and a change in thinking and a willingness to invest time and energy in this area. So what often helps with senior people who have been in these sorts of environments for a long time is to film them and show it to them. And, you know, when you show an intelligent person how they come across on camera, they will see what's working, what's not working. And, you know, as long as they have the willingness to look at it and to learn, you see very rapid progress often with those sorts of people. But yeah, there are some cases who are very in a sort of very technical mindset, and it's very hard to get them to sort of more human to human conversations. And often just the best advice is sometimes just to say, you know, what do you actually want to say? And just say that. And, you know, don't run it through sort of a system of corporate complications. Just as a human being, what are you trying to say? Or even how would you explain this to your mother? So helping them to change the perspective and giving them the questions they can then ask themselves when they find themselves in the same situation. So that's really the job, as I see it, as a sort of when you coach CEOs, that you help them transform their skill set into, you know, into master communicators, if you like. And, you know, I couldn't do their job. You know, they're running huge companies, but, you know, I have a specific skill set which I can help them develop as well. And this is how I see my role.
So it's all about the collaboration.
Yeah, and clarity is clarity is a huge part of being a good communicator. Leadership communications, you know, except it's a hard skill you need to work on. Be very clear, have the clarity, and almost over communicate with all your audiences.
I'd just like to jump ever so slightly. So we've had a couple of really interesting questions from members, from students at the university, which I'd quite like to address. And I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who got in touch with questions for Oliver. There were some really, really fantastic thinking points that I was looking through. We've had a couple of people wondering about, I guess, the value of working in the communications sector, and namely, how do you personally, and how does one more broadly, measure the positive impact of your work? And do you think it's a job which allows you to make a real difference to the world?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, like any skill, you can apply it for good and you can apply it for bad. And, you know, the great thing about having your own company or working in a company like ours, we're very clear about our values and we're very clear about who we work for and we don't work for. And of course, we all have our own sets of values, but it is, you know, completely up to us to say, you know, we're not interested in that industry or we're not interested in that particular client. And then we don't go after them. And if you don't go after companies, then you will never win them as a client. So the world is full of opportunities. So we focus on the ones that we can identify with and that we think, you know, actually help, you know, make the world better. And for me personally, yeah, I feel very passionate about this because I worked in companies and I work with, you know, people in organizations that where communication internally, externally is very poor. And this really affects people. This affects mental health at the workplace, for instance. This affects, you know, people's job security, people's life satisfaction. So this is one of the reasons why I like working with sort of the top tier and in an organization, because if you can sort of nudge them towards positive change at the top, it will filter down in the organization and everyone else will start communicating better in a more human way, in a more sort of engaging and positive way. And we know all these studies that show that most people are not particularly happy in their current jobs. And that's a shame because we spend so much time on, you know, at work. And, you know, I'm really trying to change that and, you know, as much as I can, both for my company, but also the companies we work with. So this is at a sort of a micro level in those particular companies, but also at a sort of wider society level. If you advise people, you believe in their mission, you believe in this good what they're doing. If you look at our podcast, you know, they're phenomenal people who are trying to tackle all sorts of societal challenges, you know, working with them and helping them as good as we can. You know, there's a lot of purpose in that. And for me, it's also a lot of passion. I love what I'm doing. It's, you know, it's given me access to so many interesting people and so many interesting topics, and it challenges me to learn every day. And I'd say if you enter the industry and become a communicator, and after a few years you find, you know, maybe you want to do something with even more purpose, you take all those skills. They're completely transferable. And as I said, those are hard skills, and they will just boost your career in any other area, because often that's what's lacking, with, you know, sort of part of, that's often not part of the skill set of a lot of other professionals.
Do you think it's, would you say it's a risk people run if they join one of the larger firms as a junior consultant? Is there the risk that they're going to end up on projects which perhaps they don't agree with personally? Or have you found in your experience that there's always the option to say, you know, no, I don't agree with the values of this company, and I don't think I can do my job effectively because of that?
I think it's harder in large companies, and I'm brutally honest here, you know, because I started right after my degree. I went into one of the big companies, and, you know, it was a good experience, but it is way harder in a big company to say no to a project. You've way less influence on sort of the direction of the business, the clients they go after, because they often have, you know, big shareholders in New York or London, and they have to deliver their margin. And that means usually taking on projects that may be a bit iffy, you don't feel comfortable with, but because they have to make their targets, this is what they're going to do. So I feel way more comfortable with sort of a smaller team, being quite picky about what we do. We wouldn't work for, you know, certain governments or certain companies or industries. And we can, you know, from the start, I can tell anyone who joins, you know, we're not going to work for those people. And if we have, you know, there are often cases that are a bit gray, in the gray area, which some people say, I'm perfectly happy with this, I think they're doing a good job. And others say, I can't get behind this. You know, then I would never force anyone to work on those projects or clients. And we've had some of these discussions where people had different views, and it's okay, you would not have to work on those. But yes, in big companies, it's way, way harder. And I would, you know, before you decide to join a particular company, I would always address that in an interview and say, okay, what's your policy on, you know, who do you exclude as clients? You know, what's your policy on these questions? So rather than policy, I should probably say values, because it comes down to values. The policy is derived from the values. And if the values are, you know, yes, we all have to be profitable to be in business next year and have secure jobs, but, you know, we can say there's, you know, profit and purpose, you know, in one rather than just profit.
And you said just then as well that you started off at one of the bigger agencies yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, for people who are listening to the podcast and they're thinking to themselves, this sounds great, really interested in the industry, but how do I actually break into it?
Yeah.
What's your career trajectory looked like so far? You know, what did you study at university, and at what point did you decide that communications was for you?
Yeah, I studied first degree in Germany, and then I went to the LSE to do a master there in European politics and policy. And even as a student, I was highly interested in sort of spin doctors and communications with the days of Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and so on. So it was very interesting. It was a sort of a new emerging industry in the 90s, late 90s, and I was fascinated by it because it combined all the interests I had from politics and society and business and international and languages, and fantastic. So I was always interested, and after my studies, I just moved to Brussels without a job and turned up there. So okay, I have a master in European politics and policy. I can probably score a job in Brussels somehow if I just knock on people's doors, and that's what happened. So I spent a few years in an agency there as a political communications consultant, advocacy, lobbying, and then moved into the car industry in Brussels for a few years doing lobbying there, but couldn't see myself as a lobbyist or in Brussels in the long term. And fortunately, I got a very interesting offer from EasyJet at the time, moving to headquarters in London and basically running the sort of continental European communications, political and media. And at that point in time, I didn't really have much media exposure in terms of, you know, working with the media as a professional. So I had to pick it up very quickly. And EasyJet, as you may know, was built on communication and PR and stunts and all these things. So all of a sudden, I came out of this sort of very serious policy world of Brussels and was thrown into sort of an orange hangar with lots of crazy entrepreneurial people who were just out there, causing quite a stir and, you know, moving into one country, one European country after the other, and building up bases and building up a presence and a brand. And it was such an intense and interesting period, and you know, so many stories and so many interesting people I met across Europe. It is fantastic. A lot of them I'm still in touch with. And then in 2010-11, I decided that I wanted to be my own boss, and 6 years in an orange hangar in Luton is enough, and decided to move to Berlin and set up shop. And because London is full of excellent agencies, I thought the opportunity was more in Berlin, so I moved back to my native Germany and built a you know, what I see as a very interesting high level boutique consultancy. And we team about 10 people, international, very smart people, combining sort of digital and strategic communication skills. And it's enormously enjoyable. I love it, and I love the team and everyone I work with, and we have great clients. So for me, it has been the right choice. And even though, you know, it's all been under the umbrella of communications, but it's not sort of linear, if you like. So Brussels, London, Berlin, you know, consultancy, in-house, automotive, aviation, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, it's been a very, I could say, there's always, you never know what the day brings, and there's never a boring day. And this is what I like about it. So if you have a growth mindset and you like the sort of the stress and the intensity and the immediacy, you know, this is a good job. If you like planable days, you like to work for your sort of more with yourself, you're more introverted, it may not be the best choice for you, even though mixed teams are also obviously an asset. But it plays naturally into the hands and to the strength of people who just love being out there with other people and communicate and pick up on emotions and psychology and all those sorts of things. So it's enormously enriching and engaging career, in my view.
Mm. And I suppose you're looking for people especially who kind of are very commercially aware, but also who are following the news and they're just kind of engaged with what's going on in the world, because ultimately that's what affects the work you do the most, I'd hazard a guess.
Yes. So we always love to hear from people, and we obviously like people who are engaged, who know what's going on in the world. You don't have to be news junkie. I think there's a sweet spot. So at some point in the day, you have seen the news, you know what's going on in the world, and there's more value in taking a step back and thinking rather than being tied to the screen and Twitter feeds. So as always, there's a sweet spot. But yes, you need to be aware of what's going on in the world, and not just in terms of consuming the news, but actually understanding it. And, you know, obviously, university like Oxford teaches students to think about issues, not just to look at them passively. And so we love to recruit from universities like Oxford, and we like people who are aware of what's going on in the world and who usually bring a couple of skills and a couple of you know, passions that can enrich the team. So that's what we're always looking for.
And I suppose for people listening then who are, you know, set on pursuing a career in communications once they've graduated, what should they be doing right now to make themselves more employable in terms of cultivating, you know, hard and soft skills?
A degree from Oxford or a similar university usually gets a foot in the door, and people will look at your CV, but not more than that necessarily. So the question is then, you know, Oxford plus X, what's that X factor you can bring to the table? And I think that there are like three things or three areas where people can, you know, develop skills and maybe communicate about, you know, what they can do in those areas. One is everything that's sort of digital or technical. And this is often an asset that obviously younger people, graduates, can bring to the table that, you know, 50 or may not have. You know, and technical skills or digital skills can be your social media presence, or can be podcast editing or video editing or filming or design certain software. So I often find that students make not enough of these skills, because for them it's often quite natural. But for an employer, this is really important to know. So what are your digital skills? Conversely, I would always avoid that, you know, having very little digital or technical skills to show for. You don't have to have three. You know, if you're really good at one, that's already quite an asset. And a lot of these don't take forever to acquire. So, you know, editing a podcast, yes, you need an eye for a story and an ear for a story, and you need to find out where to get the music and familiarize with certain softwares and so on. But if you have, you know, you can learn it in a couple of weeks. So it's not rocket science. Other skills are harder to acquire, obviously, but you have to at least some technical digital skills, I think, to get a foot in the door, more than a foot in the door today. And the second one, so technical digital is one. Second one is writing. Writing is extremely important for any communicator because writing means you can put a graduate on a writing task. If they can write well, they can already produce something of value very quickly because they've been writing for years. Having said that, our writing is not like academic writing. Often students and graduates have to unlearn academic writing and learn how to write journalistically. So if you can show that you can do that and have done it in whatever capacity, that's an asset. And we often, before we sort of proceed to sort of final interviews, etc., we always ask for, so we like this person, a good CV, interesting, nice person, good, fit in terms of values and culture. We then ask for writing samples. And writing samples, if someone says, oh, I only have my university essays, that's not good because we can't use those. They're not the style we will be able to show to a client, right? So if you have no pieces of writing at the moment, then just write 3 articles and put them on LinkedIn. So it's not hard to sit down and write something. And obviously you can dissect journalistic style and web writing and those things. There are tons of information out there, on Skillshare, on Google, on YouTube. So teaching yourself to write like a professional, to write in a journalistic way is extremely important. And the third one I would mention is leadership. Leadership in the sense that, you're the head of an organization, whether it's a student union or a society like you're the media society or an NGO, a non-profit, whatever it may be, in some form of capacity. It can be a sports club. Doesn't matter what, but to show that you have leadership skills. Because if people in their own peer group become leaders, it's likely that they become leaders in their professional life as well, at least more likely in my view. So they have to, they're bringing those leadership qualities, and those can be extremely important and valuable. Because keep in mind, comms is an area where you can make a very quick career. If you stick it out for a few years in an agency, because, agencies have relatively high turnover and people like to move in-house and so on. But if you stick it out, in a few years, you'll be leading a team, right? And I have people in their mid-20s who are leading teams. So it doesn't have to take long. You just have to bring some of those skills and then consciously develop them further. So as I said, so digital technical skills, writing like a journalist or like a professional, and leadership skills. And the more you have of those, the better. And as I said, some are easier to acquire over the next few weeks than others. But make sure this is very clear on your CV or very clear in your conversation and say, okay, I'm good at video editing. I can video edit. So I know as an employer, okay, if that person starts on Monday, I can put them on video editing. They're going to do that for the next month, maybe. But in the meantime, they're going to learn another skill and then they can do something else. So they can, they don't go through a sort of 3 months where they have to acquire skills before they can work on clients. They already have something that's of value.
Also, something we've spoken about a lot today is the importance of social media. So we've talked about CEOs leveraging the power of things like Instagram, things like LinkedIn to kind of build up their own reputation. How important do you think it is for students like us, like the people listening, to start not necessarily making a name for ourselves, but just kind of growing that online presence, be it on LinkedIn, be it on, a personal website, something like that? Should we be thinking about that?
Yeah, I would be thinking about it because one of the assets you have when you're young is that you're probably digital native. And if you're digital native, but you can't show digital skills, it's sort of odd, right? And it's sort of, this is what I would expect. I wouldn't expect you to have 10 years experience in corporate communications, but I would expect you to have some sort of digital footprint. I would absolutely recommend anyone to have a LinkedIn account before they go and apply. Just set up an account and understand the platform. It's professional. It's not hard to understand. It's not that fast. So it's no secret to it. It's just what it is. But this is usually the first place people go in a professional environment to check people out. They don't go on Google anymore. They just go on LinkedIn and type in a name because LinkedIn's open on the browser anyway all day. So this is very valuable. Also, I would send people like me LinkedIn invites just to, hey, I exist, even that works. So LinkedIn is key. Then obviously Instagram, Twitter, etc. Absolutely, yeah. If you can build something there, if you have your own website, maybe your own blog, you know, that's definitely helpful. And I would think about my personal brand and how I position myself, you know, when I apply. Especially this year will not be easy, obviously, but it's not hopeless. So it's just going to be a bit tougher. And I think the more you can show that you're preparing for the day of the interview, you're preparing for the first day on the job, the better, the bigger your chances are.
Mm. So basically just looking at how powerful these networks can be. And also, were you recommending kind of digital networking almost, you know, sending out invites on LinkedIn just to kind of get your name out there, connect mm-hmm. with people and just raise awareness slightly of your own profile?
Yes. Yeah, I would do that. Yeah. Because I usually say yes. And, you know, someone who looks interesting is my sort of interest, similar, you know, interests, I usually accept those invites. And let's say that person applies 3 months later, I type the name in LinkedIn, so, we already connected. Okay, interesting. So that probably puts you apart from 90% of the other applicants. So it's simple things like that, right? So sort of slight name recognition, then you could, okay, there's the link to, you know, George's website. He chaired the Media Society. Okay, good. So it's simple things like that. The first digital impression is important. I'm not saying you have to have 10,000 Instagram followers. I don't care. But some sort of digital footprint in a positive sense would be good. And obviously, conversely, you may want to avoid, you know, too many party pictures, etc. I personally don't look at those things. I don't care. You know, we've all been young, but some employers do. So just be mindful. It's going to be out there for a while. So think twice about what you want to post. Also, when it comes quite, some students are quite sort of polarizing on Twitter, things like that. You know, I would also, you know, I made a decision not to be polarizing or negative or overly political on social media. You know, I'm a political person, but you know, it's not the right medium for my sense. And it can be good to be sort of tuned in and be smart about you know, what's going on in politics and what's going on in the world. But if you're sort of becoming an active campaigner, a lot of employers would look at this critically and think, okay, how would that person fit in? Because we have to be quite flexible with a lot of things we're doing.
And all of these digital outlets, kind of, do they represent the future of working in communications? And by that, I mean that I know that you're producing podcasts, you're putting out more videos, especially at the moment. How's the industry, or how has it changed in the last few years? And where do you think it's going at the moment?
I mean, social, it's constantly changing. I have no idea where we'll be in 5 years. I have a good idea where we are in a year or two, but not in 5 years. I think anyone who claims to have is probably mistaken. But I've been using LinkedIn, Twitter professionally for about 10 years now. I introduced things like Twitter at EasyJet 2008 or so, when Twitter came up and, you know, sort of still in its infancy. And, you know, it's been around for a while. So I wouldn't say social media is still the big change factor. I would rather say video and audio, which is definitely having a moment at the moment, which has to do with bandwidth and with sort of more accessibility and more people using those tools. So LinkedIn is still there, Twitter is still there, but obviously the way we use it is much more audiovisual. So many more videos, many more audio contents. And that's a good thing, because I think it's the natural way we communicate. We like to talk to each other. So podcast just feels natural to me. You know, we are visual as humans. So video seems fairly natural if used in the right way. So in a way, sort of typing on your smartphone feels quite unnatural. So I'm not sure that social media will still be the big factor 10 years from now. I think voice is clearly gaining in importance. So voice technology, voice search. But the bigger point is from my view that those will be successful who master communications, the skills, the hard skills of communications, of persuasion, of, you know, human and emotional intelligence, and combine that with sort of technical knowledge and digital skills, which are always evolving. If you get those two together, you have a very potent mix. And a lot of organizations can't do that. They're either sort of content factory, which are good at the technical side, or they're very strategic, but they're not sure how to implement it effectively. So any person or any organization that can do both, I think, is in a very promising position.
Are you still watching the industry kind of explode in Berlin, for example, as the startup scene kind of really takes off, or has it reached saturation point, do you think?
Yeah, I think we've seen a big shift in the industry everywhere to digital. And the two sort of dimensions I see now is sort of content factory, very good at technical skills, but often lack any strategic view. So more the sort of skills that the marketeers and so advertising people use to have.
Which so the kind of creative agency type
Yeah,
things
exactly. So creative, a lot of output. In my view, I don't find it that interesting. And also it will be automated more and more in the future. So it's not a field I would necessarily go into right now. And it feels a bit like a commodity to me, but maybe I may be unfair. And on the other hand, agencies like ours are primarily strategic. And our job is not to write every tweet or design every Instagram post. Our job is to help them at a very high level to optimize their communication strategy, to tackle the biggest challenges so that they can emerge stronger. That's really how I see our role, and then helping them with the implementation. But frankly, it's easier and cheaper for a company to write their own tweets. And that, you know, every company should be able to write their own tweets and Instagram posts these days. And yes, I mean, get some external help to get started. But to me, those are core skills now, just like writing a press release. You shouldn't pay consultants to write press releases or, you know, write Instagram posts. The same thing, in my view. You should be able to do this as part of your team and pick and choose consultants and consultancies when you're entering a new arena, or it really is something like crisis communications, which require a lot of experience because the stakes are really high. But there's no harm in sort of, you know, trying various Instagram posts and seeing what works, actually. So I don't see that the stakes are particularly high there. You find and you iterate until you learn, and you learn until you found something that works for you. If, you know, and this, it's easy to say there's a strategy to Instagram, there is, but it takes a lot of iterations and trying what works for your particular audience. But you don't want to go through that process with crisis communications or financial communications or, you know, CEO communications. It has to be spot on from day one. And I think that's how I see the role of external advisors, to fill in the gaps and to help strategically and be thinking and doing partners in taking things to a completely new level.
So what's the landscape looking like at the moment, and how are businesses having to adapt to deal with the current situation?
It's a huge challenge, obviously. Everyone moved to pretty much working from home office mode. So, and this has changed the way companies communicate internally and externally, obviously. So we see more interest in podcasts and video statements, also for internal users. But I think the wider point is that companies and CEOs, C-level executives, they all have to over-communicate now. So over-communicating with your own teams, with customers, with investors is hugely important at the moment, because everyone, you know, we're in flux, the situation is very dynamic. So it is even more important now to over-communicate. And a second point I would make is that it's really important to differentiate yourself. But that's, you know, you as a professional, because times are tougher, so there's more onus on differentiating yourself from other professionals and building a personal brand, building a particular skill set are good ways of doing that. But also for companies, because I think once we get out of this, or, you know, the immediate crisis is over, whenever that may be, I think, you know, just discounting is going to be a terrible strategy. And I think this is what will happen in a lot of industries, that we come out of the crisis, companies think, well, now we're going to run, you know, we have to discount, we have to, you know, run a campaign or whatever, and stimulate demand, stimulate the market. I think if you're only relying on that, you're in for some tough times, because business will already be weakened by that time. And if you then enter into a price battle, you know, you'll be perceived as a commodity. People would just hold out for, you know, the lowest priced offers. Is not a good place to be. And I think more companies would go bankrupt after the crisis than during this acute part of the crisis because of that. So what does that mean? I think leaderships and teams in general just need to up their game and up their digital game and have a clear brand strategy in place for themselves as leaders, but also for the companies and the products, because then you can you have more pricing power. You'll be sought after more as sort of a valuable solution, as a treat or as a luxury item, or as, you know, just the best in your industry. And that gives you some pricing power. And I think that will be a differentiator between, or the difference between those who will make it and even thrive and grow in a crisis and those who will not make it. So communicate and differentiate is what I tell people at the moment.
And how do we as consumers, so if you know, if you take off your communications professional hat and think of yourself as a consumer for a moment, how do we deal with this kind of deluge of information, you know, when every second business is, you know, they're pumping out adverts, pumping out podcasts, mm-hmm. How do we kind of work out where to find value and stuff, and how do we deal with that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. We as consumers of goods, services, information, news, we pay a lot of attention to value right now because we no longer live in a world of scarcity. We live in a world of abundance. And that means that we can be very picky with what we choose, which podcast, which news provider, etc. And I think the ones that will survive are the ones that provide the most value, the best quality. And it's as simple as that, in my view. Of course, there are a lot of webinars, a lot of podcasts, a lot of things that come up. But I guess 6 months from now, very few of those will be around. And the quality and the value you provide, that will be the defining factor. And, I think people will sample a lot at the moment, but they will stick to those that really provide them actionable value.
Mm. But hopefully the silver lining there is that we see kind of higher quality content than ever before because people are aware that they need to differentiate themselves in this way.
Exactly. I think that's the upside. For consumers, I think it's a brilliant time because there's so much out there. Also, so much that maybe was behind a paywall before and is now for free. And people have understood that they need to provide a lot of value for free in order to build trust, in order to then, sell their product or service. So in a way, we live in a golden age of information services. But I also find that unless people pay for it, they're often not acting on it. So we use it as motivation and inspiration. And I learn a lot from books and, take action based on books. But a lot of people need different formats and be more committed and have more skin in the game. And, this is fine. We all learn in different ways. It's a golden age in that respect. All the information is abundantly out there and we can learn a lot from, from the laptop, from our sofa, if we choose to do so.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Oliver. These insights have been absolutely fantastic, and I'm sure people will be really grateful for them.
Thank you, Josh, for having me, and all the best to all your listeners, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you. A huge thank you to Oliver for joining us on the show today. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not check out our website at oxfordunimediasoc.com or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's all for today, and we'll see you again soon.